Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host. So today, we're going to be talking with Patrick Dunawilla. Hey, Patrick, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show, Kirk. I have too many technical people on the podcast, so I'm honored that you'd invite me on and let me share my technical perspective with your listeners.
Those of you who don't know Patrick, so Patrick does the chart report. It's an email that goes out, and it's really a fantastic intro into technical analysis. And I brought Patrick on because I really wanted to talk about the topic because it's something we don't talk about much here, but it's becoming such a huge part of the market that I think it's really important that people understand it. So Patrick, tell us a little about your background. Like, how did you get into technical analysis?
It basically by failure at first, but ultimately needing a strategy. I'm 28 years old now. I grew up in upstate New York. Literally half my immediate family is financial advisors, both my parents. Growing up, the stock market and the business of investing was very much dinner talk. It was acceptable dinner talk. And when I was probably 12 or so, my dad gave me some money and said, you know, pick a company that you think will do well over the next 10 years. And at the time, you know, the iPhone hadn't even come out yet, but I was obsessed with the iPod mini. Apple was still trading in like the teens. Wish I could say I was still holding it, but I bought Apple. I think I sold at my first like $1,000, but that's what really gave me the bug for the markets. And I'm not telling that story to brag. I tell that story because that gave me beginner's luck. And I think beginner's luck can be a really dangerous thing. And at that point, I thought everything I touched would turn to gold. And I thought I was like the next Warren Buffett, but the market quickly humbled me. And after getting knocked around enough, I ultimately realized I needed a strategy. I needed some sort of process. And that's what kind of led me to technical analysis.
So when you say it was, you know, beginner's luck's dangerous, a lot of investors out there have a similar kind of history with that because the markets mostly go up 70% of the time. So most people think that they're geniuses, right? Why is that dangerous and how should people be looking at it?
I mentioned like the past year, you know, the market's gone pretty much straight up. It's been a really easy environment to make money. And if you're not used to the downside, if you're not used to that downside risk, you know, you're in for kind of a rude awakening when it does finally come. And the more kind of luck you have, the more success you have, the bigger your confidence is and the more risk you end up taking. You know, you might take on leverage or something like that. I don't need to tell you how that story usually ends, right?
I don't know if you've experienced this, but there's a whole generation of people who have not really experienced something like 2008.
Right.
And for those people who got into the market after that, the market only goes up.
Right.
Right. And last year, that just comes back. Don't worry about it. That'll just come back.
Right. Right. And you know, I don't mean to like poo-poo those people because I was there too. And I think it's all part of the process. And, you know, once you get knocked down like that, you either take one of two paths. You say, okay, I'm going to figure out there's something to this. I just got to figure it out. I want to figure it out. Or you just say, man, the markets aren't for me. And, you know, you buy and hold or you index, which is completely fine too. You know, I took the blue pill, I guess, so to speak.
You mentioned your family, their financial advisors as well, and you're trying to get into this. So why? Actually, let's start with what is technical analysis?
It's a great question because I think a lot of people have this misconception about it. A lot of people, when they hear technical analysis, they think of chart patterns with funny names like, you know, cup and handle or double bottom or head and shoulders tops. And those are a part of technical analysis, but they're just a small part. To me, technical analysis is the study of the behavior of the market and therefore the study of market participants and how they're behaving in the market. And how do we look at that? We look at that through price. All we really care about is what is price doing. And, you know, so much of the time, price moves and then the narrative follows. And it's not exactly clear at the time why price is happening, but we don't really care about why. We just care that it is happening. And we want to take note and act accordingly. But I think that's worth repeating. It's the study of the behavior of the market. So we're interested in price action itself rather than the goods and services behind the companies or indices that we're analyzing.
Let's use a live example because I think it'd be interesting. You know, if I'm looking at, let's say interest rates like treasuries right now, and everyone thinks inflation is inevitable and it's going to be high, and yet interest rates are dropping. So somebody who's kind of bought into the narrative that inflation equals higher interest rates might be surprised by that move. But how would like a technical analyst look at that?
Right. So as a you know, technical analysis, I really believe is kind of more of an umbrella term than people realize. It's not just chart patterns. It's things like sentiment and breadth and momentum and even seasonality all fall under the TA or the technical analysis kind of umbrella. And, you know, to your point about interest rates, sentiment, you know, with inflation, we saw like all those magazine covers saying inflation's here. I mean, everywhere you look, it's almost like widely accepted. It's consensus that we're going to have inflation. And yet the 10-year, you know, that's a great example you use. The 10-year is not suggesting that right now. You know, the last couple of weeks, the 10-year has been selling off, and you wouldn't expect that if inflation was really where everyone's saying it is.
I mean, the economics numbers came out and showed, hey, in May we had 5% inflation. So who's right, the 5% inflation or the bond market?
Yeah, I mean, you got me there, because I think that one's still, the jury's still out on that, and we'll see how it resolves. And it's interesting because you're seeing a couple different signals, even for interest rates, like copper gold saying one thing, and then you look at how the 10-year's trading and it's saying something totally different. So I think the jury's still out on that one. But, you know, to your point, the trend is continuing lower here. And at the beginning of the year, it seemed like almost consensus that we were going to reach 2%. You know, now we're kind of reversing. Whether or not we end up there, we could. But, you know, that brings up another good point. I think another misconception about technicals is that it's predictive and that it's, you know, that it's a forecasting tool, when it's really more of a risk management tool. Just because something starts breaking its 200-day or something doesn't mean that it has to continue lower. All it means is that it's telling you that you might, the risk is to the downside at that point. You want to err on the side of caution rather than be super aggressive at that point. So it's just kind of more of a risk management tool rather than something predictive.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because we can't predict the future, right? But we can manage risk.
And that's the beauty of it, right? But there are some people that I think do treat technicals that way, where they think that, okay, it broke this, it has to go down. You have to take the approach of strong opinions held lightly, where you got to be ready to change your mind. And there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think, if the situation changes, if price action changes.
I mean, that must be really hard, though. You're talking about, you mentioned strong opinions held lightly, which I 100% agree with you. You know, for people, like we're psychological beings, how do you kind of square that? You're coming up with a thesis, right? Whether it's a fundamental thesis or a technical thesis. I like using this example as the interest rates, because I think there's so many, it's such a strong one-sided opinion, which, you know, as I'm sure you can attest, things frequently go against the crowd when everyone's on one side of the boat. It kind of usually goes the other way. Right. So how can somebody handle that? You're assuming there's going to be inflation, interest rates are going up, and then it doesn't. How do you handle that?
You know, for someone like me, I focus solely on price. That's like my final arbiter in everything. And a lot of people might think it's kind of arrogant to ignore the news and fundamentals and all that like we do. I mean, we, you know, a lot of us technical analysts, we try to put blindfolds on basically to all of that. We call it noise. But there's a good reason for doing that. And the reason is to stay objective in our analysis. And if we're trading off price, or if we're positioning off price, then that's our thesis. So once that changes, that's where we're wrong. And that's what I love about technicals, is it tells you where you're wrong. In fundamentals, it can be very difficult to do that. You know, I told you that story earlier of how getting knocked around ultimately led me to technicals. I'll give you a quick story. There was this biotech company. It was like a gene editing company. And it had the most like appealing story to it. It sounded like the company of the future. I bought in, and because it was also going up too. So it was a momentum stock at this point. And then, you know, you get that first 10% down day and you say, well, it's still a really cool company. It's still a really interesting company. I'll continue to hold it. It'll go back up. And then it falls another 10%. And you're like, they're still doing really cool stuff. And, you know, you keep saying that until next thing you know, you're at a 60% drawdown and you need 120% just to get break even, kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yep, I do. Been there, done that.
It gives you a clear cut point of where you're wrong. And is it difficult to deal with? God, yeah. I mean, it sucks when you get stopped out of the market because that's the market telling you you are wrong. But to be able to be told you're wrong at a small loss and be able to move on to the next opportunity, that's really valuable to me rather than getting your arm ripped off and then finally realizing you're wrong and having to sell and make that realization at a devastating drawdown.
I get a quote that I love from George Soros, which is, it's not a matter of whether you're right or wrong. It's how much you make when you're right and how much you lose when you're wrong.
Yes.
Can you kind of explain that to the listeners a little bit and how that applies to technical analysis?
And George Soros, you know, he is kind of a closet technician. I know he's also kind of a macro guy, but when it comes to trends, that man, he really knows what he's talking about. In fact, he has something called the theory of reflexivity. If anyone's interested, he has a whole lecture series on it. But the quote was, it's not how much you make when you're, what is it? It's not how much.
It's not whether you're right or wrong. It's how much you make when you're right and how much you lose when you're wrong.
But yeah. So if you're aiming to make 1-3, let's say, 3 or 3-1 on each trade, right? So if you're wrong, you lose one unit or $1, let's say. And if you're right, you make $3. You can literally be wrong over half the time and still make money. I mean, that's a crazy concept. It's a lot harder in actual execution because when the market's telling you you're wrong over and over, it can really mess with your head. It can drive you to take on more risk or just do crazy things. But if you just respect that math and continuously take those skewed risk and reward scenarios where, you know, you're aiming to make 3 or better yet 5 or 10-1, you can be wrong a majority of the time and still make money. I mean, that's incredible. I can sit here and say it, but you know, when you're sitting there and you have a trade on and you get stopped out, it's really tough to deal with in the moment. But more often than not, the next day or the next week, I'm looking at that position from the outside saying, man, I'm glad I'm not in that thing most of the time. There's always those other few times where it'll rip right in your face and you're like, man, what did I do? But you know, you made the right decision at the right time, given the information you had. And if you can say that, you're a good trader.
Well, yeah, I think it kind of brings in this psychological aspect of trading, right? Because I mean, if you're a fundamental analyst, you're kind of choosing your decisions based on the numbers and kind of the information that you know, and you might feel a little bit more comfortable sitting in, like taking a 25 or 30 or 40% drawdown because you know the numbers are accurate. Whereas technical analysts, you don't really care so much about the numbers, right?
That's a fair criticism of technicals too, is, you know, we don't have a long leash. And that's why for the most part, technicals are more geared towards tactical, shorter time frame market participants or traders rather than investors. I found that technicals actually work really well on longer time periods. You know, some of those long-term trends, they persist for years. And also using relative strength to position yourself to position, you know, overweight and underweight sectors within your portfolio. That's all technicals, you know, whether you want to call it that or not.
Let's just say for somebody looking to get into technical analysis or at least understand it better, what are some of the things that they should be looking for and how should they kind of dip their toe into these waters?
You know, the first step whenever I look at any chart is the trend. You've heard the phrase, the trend is your friend. If something's in an uptrend, the company must be executing right. They're probably executing right. If something's in a downtrend, they're probably doing something wrong. For example, like something I do when I'm telling people about trend following for the first time is I'll show them two different charts and I don't tell them what they are. And one of the charts is in a clear downtrend, right? And the other one's in a clear uptrend, like the line is just up and to the right, yeah, steady uptrend. And I ask them, I say, which one of these is JCPenney's and which one is Lululemon? And almost every time the people get it right. What that's getting at is one of these companies is executing right, and therefore they're in an uptrend. Price is moving higher. One of these things is clearly doing something wrong, or you know right off the bat that you want to avoid it. So using that first rule of thumb of only buying uptrends or only buying things that are moving higher, I think is a great rule of thumb. Now, it's kind of counterintuitive to the idea of buy low, sell high. But, you know, we believe in momentum and basically buying high and selling higher a lot of the times. And we really like, you know, long base breakouts where price goes nowhere for years and then finally starts working. And an example that comes to mind right now, like emerging markets, you know, they've gone nowhere for what, a decade and are finally breaking out now. What that does is that totally wakes up the animal spirits when you see all-time highs like that for the first time in over a decade, and there's no longer resistance from people who are underwater left to put selling pressure on price. So you kind of have clear blue skies for price to finally move forward once you break out to all-time highs.
You're bringing in some interesting things to think about. So, you know, you mentioned buy high and sell higher. I think a lot of people get scared because, you know, hey, the price is at all-time highs and it's expensive. It kind of brings in the question of how do you know when to sell and how do you know when to buy? So maybe you can kind of talk about like how you determine when to buy.
You know, I mentioned before, you know, that sentiment, breadth, momentum, those are all components of technicals, right? And the art of it is, I think, knowing when to use each one of those tools. If you're a carpenter, you know, you might not use a paintbrush to hang a photo or hang a picture frame or something. You know, you got to use the right tools for the right job. And something like sentiment is a great tool, but it's really only useful at extremes. And we saw that perfectly in the past year or two, right? Extreme bearishness at the March low. That was a sign that maybe you want to be a buyer at that point. It's easy to say in hindsight. I totally get that. But if we're being a student of the markets here, you know, that would have been a first indication that maybe you want to start nibbling. And then once we finally broke out to all-time highs, because it was like a V-bottom, if you guys don't remember, and then I think it was like around August or end of the summer last year, we finally actually broke out to, we broke above the February highs. Like basically we had retraced that entire decline from, you know, the COVID crash, which was incredible that it only took a few months. And at that point, again, it would have been very difficult to buy that all-time high, right? Because unemployment was still terrible and the economy was still shut down. Things were really, really bad. And anybody who studied traditional finance would probably be running for the hills. But seeing price break out to all-time highs to us was an indication that, you know, the market's pricing in something good. It's telling us that the worst is behind us and we might have blue skies moving forward.
That makes a lot of sense. I think in hindsight, everything's really easy to look at that way. I think it was definitely, I think you're right. It was definitely hard in the moment because who would have thought the whole world is shut down economically and yet markets hitting all-time highs? That doesn't make any sense, but here we are.
I remember when we, you know, retested the 200-day moving average from below, I was still bearish at that point. We had rallied probably 20 or 30% at that point, and I was still bearish. But as soon as we broke above that and then we broke out to all-time highs a few months later, it was a clear indication that you had to be on the bullish side of the trend because the market was telling you that price was moving higher regardless of what the headlines were saying at the moment. And they were scary headlines. I mean,
yeah, they were. They still are.
That's the point. They'll always be that, right? They'll always be a reason not to sell. But if you're just listening to price and price is trending higher and you have all these moving averages, long-term and short-term, sloping up and to the right like you have now and like you had for the majority of the past year, that can give you enough faith to keep you in. So even if you are a fundamental person or you do follow that stuff, I don't mean to poo-poo it, but if I can leave something with you, it's that, you know, you can use the trend as a way to complement what you're already doing and as that risk management tool to let you know that the narrative might be changing and that you might be wrong, even if the environment doesn't look like it's changed yet, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's good advice. What about selling? Because that's another hard thing, right? I think a lot of people tend to, when it goes against them, they tend to hold on and wait till it comes back, which is always my favorite justification. Oh, I'm going to wait till it comes back. Or the other side of it, which is it's going up and it's up, so maybe I should sell and take my profits. So how should people look at when to sell?
That's a really tough one. For me, it's a little different. I use like very specific technical indicators like Fibonacci and stuff like that for my price targets. But for other people, I think you want to look for you know, signs of deterioration and signs that momentum is slowing. So when you have a really strong trend, a lot of the times those trends are feeding off the momentum, and it gets to a point where that's the only thing sustaining the trend. And usually at that point, it's getting to a point where it's no longer sustainable. And you want to look for a deterioration in momentum. So basically the rate at which it's going up is kind of starting to slow a little. That might be a sign that, okay, price is kind of slowing down and, you know, we want to be taking some profits off the table, raising cash a little bit. But that's a tough one. You know, you've had a lot of those moments throughout the rally too. And, you know, you could also use, like I mentioned earlier, sentiment is most useful at extremes. You know, unfortunately, it's usually clearest in hindsight. But, you know, if you start to see some signs that everyone's in stocks, you might want to take some off the table so that if we do get another 10% correction or 20% correction or whatever, that you have some to step in and nibble at that point.
One of the things that comes up is time frames. When you look at technicals, you can look at a 1 second view, a 1 minute view, an hour view, a day view. How do you look at the time frames when it comes to technical analysis?
Trading and investing is more unique to each person than like their thumbprint. No two people do it the same. So, and most of the time that comes from a difference in time frame. So what's great about technical analysis is the principles are what we call fractal, which mean that in a weekly 10-year chart, the same patterns and the same principles apply to a short-term 5-minute chart, intraday 5-minute chart, meaning trend is the most important thing. And then looking for momentum divergences or chart patterns or candlestick patterns, those work in any time frame. So if you are a short-term swing trader, you might want to use a shorter time frame chart. If you're a investor, you know, you can still use technicals and buy breakouts on longer time frame charts. So you want to be looking at weeklies or monthlies probably even. And that will still give you a very long-term perspective. And I know a lot of people that actually do position themselves that way, where they'll buy monthly breakouts and they're in the trade for months. And so, you know, you can't call someone like that a day trader. And I think a lot of people think that technicals are really only for the day trader, the, you know, guy who's sitting in front of his terminal with 100 charts up. I know a lot of people who, you know, Sunday night, they'll sit down and, or even once a month, they'll do a monthly candlestick chart review, go look through a bunch of different monthly candlestick charts. And if they see one that's breaking out, they'll buy that and they might be in it for a few months. And by the way, when I say a monthly candlestick chart, I mean each little candle is 1 month. So usually you're looking at, if it's a monthly candlestick chart, it might be over the course of 10 or 20 years. But those help you really tune out all the noise and really see big picture structural trends.
I mean, it sounds to me like if somebody's looking at charts, it makes sense to look through multiple timeframes. So not just like a single one, but multiple also, to see.
Right. And also knowing your time frame and knowing what you're comfortable with and what your style is, selecting the right time frame to analyze and also kind of do your work off of.
Let's talk through, if I look at kind of some of my platforms, there must be, you know, if I'm looking at the one I'm looking at now, there's got to be over 100 different technical tools that I could use. Things that I've never heard of, but they sound really interesting. So, you know, if you're looking at technical analysis or starting to use it, how do you determine which tool to use? Like, do you use them all? Do you just choose one? Like, how do you kind of look through that?
I think that's a really good question. To be honest, I'm not a huge indicator guy. Most of my charts, the only indicator I have is relative strength index or RSI. And that's a momentum indicator. What I mentioned before, where, you know, if something's been trending higher for quite some time, I'm looking for it to lose momentum as a sign that I might want to get out. So when I start seeing RSI put in what's called a bearish divergence, a bearish momentum divergence, that to me is an indication. So that's one indicator I use, but I generally try to steer clear from using indicators, and I really put a lot of emphasis on trend. And the best way to identify trends is a moving average. Almost every charting platform will have a moving average. The simplest would be to use, you know, a 200-day moving average for the kind of longer-term stuff, and then a 50-day is kind of your immediate or intermediate term, I'm sorry, intermediate term trend indicator. And then maybe like a 20-day moving average would be a short-term indicator. And those help you also separate the time frame analysis thing. You know, if it's breaking the 20, you know the short-term bias is to the downside. But if it's above the 50 and 200, you know, it's still in a longer-term uptrend. If it's below the 50, then, you know, you start having a little bit more problems. It's in an intermediate-term downtrend. And if it breaks that 200, you know, it's probably a good thing to get out of at that point.
You know, when you talk about moving averages, I mean, there's exponential, there's simple. Like, do you have a preference?
I tend to stick to simple moving averages. I think, you know, at that point, it just becomes whatever people prefer or what they're comfortable with. I tend to just use a simple moving average. But yeah, as far as the indicators go, I pretty much stick to moving averages and trend analysis and look for momentum divergences.
Let's look at some of the patterns. I've noticed certain people I follow, they have certain things that they focus on. Like they focus on head and shoulders as a pattern. That seems to be one I see a lot where people focus on that. And they're trying to identify a cup and handle. They're just trying, you know, they've got like two or three go-tos and that's what they do. There's a ton of different patterns out there. So do you have a specific patterns that you like or do you look for them all or?
For the most part, I look for big bases, big rounded bases. I think it was the Louise Yamada. She's a very well-respected technician. She said, the bigger the base, the higher in space. What I mean by a base is like a big rounded cup almost looking thing. And the longer that base took to form, the better it is and the more the upside breakout tends to be. You know, a great example of that would be gold. Actually, even Bitcoin. You know, regardless of what you think about Bitcoin, I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist or anything like that. But when it broke out from the 2017 highs, it was an indication to us, at least, that, you know, this could really get interesting here. Because from a psychological perspective, what that pattern, what that giant cup pattern is actually representing is, you know, you had people who bought in at the 2017 top. They totally got sucked in by all the hype. Then they got taught a really tough lesson. And then they turned into the buy and hold person, right? Like, oh, I'll just hold on to this until it recovers, right?
Yeah.
And they're praying to God for the next 2 years. Oh, please just get me back to break even. Please just get me back to break even. And then it finally does. If they held for that whole time, they're probably not going to stop holding at that point. And, you know, as soon as it broke out, broke the 2017 highs, I think it was around 20,000. It quickly ran to 40,000 within a couple weeks. I mean, it doubled within a couple weeks. I'm sure narratives come out around that. And we have seen that. We've seen a ton of narratives come out around Bitcoin. But to us, it was pretty simple. It was price was breaking out to an all-time high after a long time of no all-time highs. So that repair process was complete. Anyone who held through that whole drawdown felt vindicated at that point and was going to keep holding on. And so there's psychology behind the pattern too, is what I'm trying to say. It's not just this line on a chart. There's actual buyer and seller mentality behind those patterns. Say that big base breakout pattern. And I think like William O'Neill, if you're familiar with IBD, he was one that really popularized that big base breakout kind of strategy.
You know, what do you trade? Do you trade stocks, ETFs, futures, options? What do you
typically trade? Yeah, mostly just stocks and ETFs. Sometimes I'll put a position on through options if I think that's the best way. I do like the element of options that where basically, you know, your stop loss is built into it if you're just buying a call or buying a put. I think that, you know, if you're just trying to make a trade, that's actually kind of a good way to manage risk because if you're wrong, you're only risking what you paid for the option. As long as you're not going crazy and buying a ton or buying more than you can afford to risk, I think it's a pretty appropriate way to limit the downside.
I mean, that's one of the reasons I use options. It just helps manage the risk of the investment because I think stop losses are a problem unless you're sitting in front of your computer all day and managing that. You can't put them in the market.
I have really grown to like ETFs a lot too. I do love that you don't have that single stock risk. And I hate earnings. I hate being in a stock around earnings. So, you know, it takes out some of that single stock risk. Every once in a while, you'll have one of the biggest components in the ETF, you know, make a big move and that'll mess it up. But for the most part, I really like the diversification they offer. And, you know, there's so many out there these days that it gives you, you know, if you want to play the breakout in crude oil, instead of going out and buying crude oil futures, you know, you can buy XOP, like the oil services ETF or something like that, and play that theme, but just in a different way if you're not comfortable with something like futures.
What about technology? You know, when it comes to trading and charting, I mean, I know what I use, but there's so many people have their preference. You know, when it comes to making it easy, you know, what have you seen that kind of works well and that other people use successfully?
There's so many great tools out there that are free too. And again, this makes me bullish on technical analysis as a way of looking at markets. I see a lot of young people my age gravitating towards charts because they kind of naturally understand that and they're able to check it. You know, 30 years ago, you couldn't just dial up a chart the way we can now. You can't just go on your phone and look at a chart 30 years ago. We're lucky to have that capability. My go-to is TradingView, the charts for the most part. I pay for their subscription, but if you want to just use their free charts, that totally works too. But I think they have a ton of great tools. Their indicators are open sourced, so you can go through their library of other users' indicators and find interesting ones that other people have shared and, you know, apply them to your own charts and stuff. And they have a bit of like a social network there too, if that's something you're interested in. Another great tool I use is Coifin. Are you familiar with Coifin?
I am not. No, I've never heard of that.
So they have a ton of great tools, especially for analyzing even like mutual funds and ETFs. They're basically like a Bloomberg Lite, but free for now, at least. I don't know when they're going to change that. But for now, Coifin's this awesome free platform. And I'll tell you, it's my go-to. Like as soon as I wake up and want to figure out what the market's doing that day, I go to my dashboard on Coifin and I'm able to get a pulse of the market pretty quickly just from that one page. And again, that's coifin.com and it's completely free. Obviously, I use Twitter a lot and rely on listening to other people and kind of listening to what they're talking about. And I'm not saying I'm just following them blindly, but kind of weighing all these different people's opinions and knowing who to follow and who to listen to and who not to listen to too. You know, there's a lot of the times I'll see people saying something and I'm like, I think I'd actually rather do the opposite than that. So using things like Twitter or StockTwits to your advantage, it's a thing that we have now that we didn't have 10 years ago, that if you can figure out how to use it to your advantage, that's huge.
It's a great point because, you know, there's a difference between noise and useful information. You know, I know years back, I had some clients who I would consider contrarian indicators, meaning that they always wanted to buy at the top and they always wanted to sell at the bottom. So anytime I get a call,
tell them that though, because you're going to ruin data.
Well, at some point they got a little comfortable and they stopped doing it. But a friend of mine calls it the mother indicator. You know, like anytime his mother calls and says, "Oh, should we be doing this?" He says, "All right, time to sell." Yeah.
And I have those people too. I mean, God bless them; they're great people, but when your friend from high school is calling you to tell you how to buy, which cryptocurrency to buy, not should I buy Bitcoin, they're saying, which one should I buy? It's probably a sign that, man, maybe it's a little too hot right now. And again, you know, sentiment at extremes can be a really useful indicator at extremes. And also it's a short-term indicator. So knowing when to use each tool is extremely important. And I think that's part of the art to it. Again, that is a fair criticism of technical analysis, is that it's a little bit subjective. But I would argue that fundamentals can be just as subjective. You know, you're given what you think are solid numbers, but a lot of the times they're built on estimates and earnings can be revised and things like that. So, you know, you might think that a fundamentalist is dealing with perfect information, but I think that's far from it.
Yeah, there was a funny tweet I saw months ago, and it said, I think there's a bubble in people seeing bubbles.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. Yeah. Let me ask you this as we're getting close to wrap up here. Who are some of the more successful technical analysts out there, at least historically or maybe currently, that people can kind of follow or at least be aware of?
Can I name a few?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
So, my personal favorite technician, his name's John Roque. He was actually George Soros's, one of his trusted analysts for a while. And then eventually George Soros kind of cut him his own book and John managed Key Square Capital. And it was a big chunk of change. I think they grew from like 2 billion to like 4 billion very quickly. And again, he was doing it all just on trends and price. And I know John is kind of similar in the sense that he's not a huge indicator guy. So a lot of these things that you might think technicals are, it's really more of just respecting price action and the trend. It can really be that simple. The nuances on top of that are the things like momentum and sentiment and breadth that once you've identified the trend can help you kind of be aware of when that trend might be reversing. But some other technicians, I'm basically kind of a disciple of JC Peretz. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but JC's been a friend and a mentor for pretty much my whole career. And so I can't help but look at things in a similar fashion to him. He's another big one for me.
JC, actually, he at some point a while ago, somebody reached out to be a guest on the show, and I'd love to have him, but then whoever the person was dropped the ball. So
I'll have to tell him to come on.
Yeah, definitely tell him to come on. I'd love to have him. He's a funny guy. I love his stuff.
But I'll tell you, he'll probably say a lot of the same things I did because I learned a lot from him. And I think that whole way of looking at the markets is really interesting. And I think he takes it to another degree. I mean, he is, do not look at any news. Do not look at any fundamentals. I've kind of adopted that over the years, but I do think, I don't want to say that fundamentals have no place. I think if anything, they can just complement what you're already doing.
It brings an interesting aspect, which maybe we'll talk in the panel portion of the show, is, you know, there's growth versus value investing. And value has been out of favor for over 10 years, pretty much since 2008. It just started to come back into favor in the last, seven, 9 months, which is great. It's great to see. Who knows if it'll continue, but it's nice to see that value stocks do exist, but that's more fundamental analysis. So does that play into your thinking, whether it's like growth versus value? Do you kind of look at, if value's in favor, do you look at the fundamentals? Or you still stick with the technicals?
Absolutely. And I think that relationship best shows up in the technicals. I mean, you look at that ratio, the ratio chart of growth versus value, that's probably one of the five most important charts to watch right now is that ratio, because it's kind of in no man's land right now. And it's really unclear, you know, are we going to see value outperform like a lot of people think, or are we going to see, you know, growth step back and resume its leadership like it has been? That one's kind of tied to the rates thing, right? Where what way is that going to happen? And another one that's kind of in that spot right now is commodities too. I think that's a really interesting one from like almost like a positioning sentiment and positioning perspective. Like if commodities did really start picking up here, I bet a lot of people aren't positioned for that. And rightfully so. They've been terrible it's been dead money for the past decade. A lot of investors haven't seen an environment where commodities are really outperforming. If they do, I mean, they have been doing fantastic this year so far. And if they do continue that, I think it could get really interesting from a positioning standpoint and seeing people kind of performance chase or kind of rush to get exposure to it. I don't know. What are you seeing from that? Are you getting any questions from your clients?
Actually, it's an interesting question. Yeah, I remember back in the day, they used to refer to it as stocks, bonds, and commodities. They stopped doing that long ago because no one's paying attention. When I was starting out, I started out in late 99, which is a great time to start this industry, by the way.
what a time.
December of 99, technically, is when I started. What I found interesting is back then I was looking at these allocations that people were using. They were using historical allocations and all that. And what I found interesting is gold was in there, but gold had been out of favor for like 20 years. So I remember looking at gold and people were like, nah, don't put that in there. That's trash. Like no one invests in gold. And that was literally the bottom of the market. It only went up from there. But
I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, they had an article titled Gold is Really Just a Pet Rock. And that was the bottom. And I think 2015.
I love those articles that kind of mark the tops and bottoms. But so to answer your question, people have not been talking about commodities pretty much my whole career, and they're not starting now. I follow some people who are more in the front of the curve when it comes to identifying these things, and they are talking about it, but from clients, absolutely not.
Nobody's asking you to add lumber to the portfolio.
No, I mean, people see it take off and then they get afraid because it's up 300%. But I remember in 2007, people did, you know, they did notice like commodities were taking off and everybody wanted to jump on the bandwagon. Then of course that reversed. I think the sentiment is people aren't talking about it yet.
But yeah, I do think that one's definitely an interesting to watch right now because it could go either way, you know?
Yeah, I guess it depends a lot on inflation.
And I get why they've been so abandoned as an asset class, because they do require a lot more tactical management, right? Like you can't just buy and hold commodities. It's not the same as a stock or a bond or any income producing asset. You really do have to have someone tactically managing it. And again, you add the fact that it's just been dead money for the past decade. I understand why it's been such an unloved asset.
I think you make a great point. It is not based on fundamentals, you know, right. Commodities. I guess to some degree it is, you know, if you're following, you know, the agricultural cycle and the weather patterns and all that. But generally speaking, it's more or less, I mean, the commodity traders are basically technicians from right. what I understand. So we got to wrap it up here. And I appreciate you coming on the show, Patrick. And for all the listeners here, Patrick has done us a solid and has offered to allow the listeners to sign up for his chart report for free. Any kind of parting thoughts that people can take away from this interview?
If you're interested in the chart report, you know, we write it every single day and it's completely free. So it covers the markets from a technical perspective. I give a brief summary. I do a chart of the day, you know, kind of the most interesting chart that stands out to me. And then I do top links. So interesting articles or interviews that I've seen or podcasts. And then I do quote of the day. That's a lot of people's favorite. I've become known by my friends as Platitude Pat because just in conversation, I'll just drop some corny quote. And then I usually end with the top 10 tweets. So the top 10 charts that I see on Twitter throughout the day, I kind of put them all there and I kind of try to make them flow into and put certain themes together so that they stand out at you.
Awesome. Well, for all the listeners who want to sign up for this, I highly recommend it. I think it's phenomenal. When I learned about it, I love it. It's one of the things I read every day. If you want to do that, just go to moneytreepodcast.com/thechartreport. So the chart report. We're getting into the panel portion of the show here. So this week we have a smaller panel. It's just me and Barb this week. How's it going, Barb?
It's going great, Kirk. How are you doing this week?
Doing well, doing well. So let's kind of dive right in. I know this is a little bit of a different angle for you. So what were some of your takeaways from the interview?
Okay, charting, technical analysis. Okay, this is sometimes looked at as a contrast of investment style from fundamental analysis. And fundamental analysis looks at the earnings and the revenue and decides whether a company has good growth prospects going forward and thus would be smart to invest. And then you decide what time you want to invest. Technical analysis, as Patrick discussed on the interview, was you don't care about what's going on with the fundamental factors of the company. All you care about are price movements. So my takeaway is technical analysis in and of itself, I don't really even consider it investing. Okay, shoot me. I can handle it. I'm not saying it's not a thing. And I'm not saying I don't look at charts because I do look at charts and I actually love charts. But investing, well, I look at investing as buying companies, owning a part of that company, and participating in their growth for now and the future.
Let's have a little back and forth here, Barb, because I know you're a fundamental analyst and have been. And I would say the fact that you look at charts, that means that, you know, maybe in terms of entry points, that is a form of technical analysis, even if it's superficial. I think one of the things to think about for, you know, the investors is, and this is kind of where the back and forth comes from, is, you know, what's really most important. So, Barb, why do you invest? Like, what's the point of investing from your standpoint?
The point of investing is I want to make more money. I don't want my money to sit there in a bank or a CD making, well, today, nothing. But in general, in the past, fixed assets made around 5%, whereas stocks earned roughly 9 to 10% per year on average. So, hey, when I have my savings, I don't want it to sit there. I want it to grow.
You know, I think it's a great point. And I think the thing about technical analysis, they're also looking for the same thing. You know, they're also looking for the money to grow. They just look at it a little bit differently. Now, I would say the fundamental versus technical analysis is two ends on the spectrum. You know, on one end, you've got Barb, which is focus on the numbers, you know, over long periods of time, the numbers lie. I'm not going to put words in her mouth, but the brief part of it is you're really focused on the company's numbers, and that's what's most important. technical analysis is the other extreme, where people are primarily, they don't care about the numbers, they care about the price. There are many other things they care about, but let's just say this, the most important thing they care about is the price. I think it's a different way that people can invest. I know a lot of really smart people who have, you know, CFAs, so they're no slouch when it comes to investing, who also end up being a technical analyst because it's just more data that they can input in the investing decision. But Barb, I know since you're more a dyed-in-the-wool fundamental analysis type of girl, how do you kind of look at that versus technical analysis in your experience? Because I imagine you don't look at it as it's useless, but like, where do you put it on the spectrum of usage?
I look at the data. So a lot of what I'll do first is I'll look at the research. Which investment strategies have tended to, over the long term, proven to be the best and most sound ways to grow your money? Okay, so that's number one. The research is pretty clear that taking an index fund investing approach, which I've talked about ad infinitum, and so you can just skip through this part if you're sick of me discussing it, but it's called a passive investment strategy, where you don't look to beat the markets, but you look to participate in their overall long-term growth, which has been upwards. So that's my, and the research has shown that over long periods of time, active fund managers, mutual fund managers, typically do not beat performance of the passive approach. Each year, on average, 30% of them do, but it's very difficult to outperform the market indices year over year. Now, I'm not saying some people don't, some people do, and some people who do may not be active fund managers, and because they're so skilled, they don't publish their results, and we don't know about them. So that is why I lean towards a passive index fund approach. But that's not saying I don't do anything else, because I do. I'm human. I enjoy investing as an activity. So I have 5% of my money that I just do other stuff. I buy and sell individual stocks. I might check out crowdfunding. That's how I approach different types of strategies. I am not a proponent of a strict technical analysis investment approach.
At least from my perspective, I kind of look at this as kind of a spectrum. Right? You could be an extreme on one side or the other, or, you know, you could be somewhere in the middle. What I like to do is I like to look at this and, you know, I like to pick companies from a fundamental perspective. So if a company is garbage on a fundamental scale, then I just won't invest in it. And I know sometimes that leaves money on the table for some of these high flyers. You know, if I can't get comfortable with the stock that's going to be around after a recession or a huge sell-off, you know, that to me is a risk. The way I look at it is I put together screens for, you know, what stocks are viable stocks and then do some additional research. And I use technical analysis for when to get in and when to get out. So I think one of the aspects when it comes to risk management is, you know, what price you buy it at and what price you sell it at. And I think Barb probably wouldn't argue the point either, is you have to find a price point that's going to lower your risk, right? I know that investing is almost the opposite of human nature. Like when you go to the store and there's a sale, people want to load up on that item and buy as much as they can. But when stocks go on sale, people don't do that. They sell. It's the opposite. You know, I think it's important to combine the two aspects so that people can use the fundamentals as a risk management system, or at least knowing what stocks you own and want to own them, right? So if you own a company that's the last buggy whip maker, you know, in the world, you probably don't want to own it, even if you like buggy whips. So you need to understand what you own. But on the other aspect also is getting in and out of the trades is also important. So Barb, from talking to Patrick and a few other people we've had on the show, you know, technical analysis really colors the way that they get in and out of trades. So how do you, from a fundamentals perspective, get in and out of trades?
I don't disagree with you, Kirk, in terms of looking at the charts. And although I only own like two or three stocks now, most of everything else I own are funds. But when I'm analyzing maybe a fund or an individual stock, like you said, if it's priced at the peak of its valuation, and I use the price earnings ratio as kind of a back of the napkin, really quick check to determine whether an asset, a stock, or a fund is really overpriced. And it's trading at a very high price earnings ratio in contrast with its average, or if it's at the top price it's ever sold at, even if it's a really good company, I'm not going to buy it because I think my upside of how much money I can make on the upside is probably limited. So I will look at the charts and I'll say, you know, it doesn't look like it has a whole lot of room to go up at this point. I'll keep this company or this fund on my radar. And if it has a price pullback, then I might buy it then. So that's a way that I might incorporate what might be considered a technical analysis approach. Now, there is one strategy which is called momentum investing, and that's a technical analysis strategy. And there is some research behind the efficacy or the support for this strategy. And in plain English, it means when something's going up, it's going to continue to go up. And so technical analysts in general frequently will use their charts to jump on a stock that is going up and ride it and continue to go up until they get some sort of indicator that the tides have changed and it'll go down. And so there is some data behind that type of approach to investing.
It's interesting because I think, you know, if I'm not mistaken, Barb, you're more of a value investor, right?
Yeah, that is not a secret.
Okay. So I also have a very kind of value bias to the way I look at things. So I think Barb and I are on the same page. But when it comes to growth investing, as Barb accurately pointed out, like momentum investing is a thing. And there's actually a lot of research that points out that stocks that are high continue to go higher. I know it's kind of weird from a value investor standpoint because you want to buy when things are cheap. You know, and there are different risks for value investors than there are for growth investors. You know, value investors, one of the risks is you buy something as cheap, well, it can get cheaper. You think of all the, in 2008, all the value managers that were buying, you know, Washington Mutual and Countrywide and all these banks because they were so cheap, but well, they kept getting cheaper. And,
yep,
and that is,
I've been there too. Yes. Yeah. Because part of a strategy was I would look at a really sound company that took, you know, went back when I was a portfolio manager and picking stocks, I go, oh, wow, this, and I have a story if I can just dive in, which is Nokia. And Nokia was an incredible cell phone maker back in the day. It was like the premier cell phone maker. And I was thrilled when it pulled back. I said, finally, my chance to get into Nokia. So it pulled back, bought some shares, and lo and behold, it dropped like 70% from where I had purchased it. And it continued to trade in the $5 range. It probably is still there. When after a while, I realized Nokia is not coming back. I am selling my shares. I am taking my loss and I am moving on. And that is a case in point of when just because it's cheap doesn't mean it's not good. The tides had changed on Nokia, and Nokia got taken over by a lot of other more forward-looking phone companies, phone maker companies.
That's one of the risks of value investing. I think momentum investing has different risks because you're buying a stock that's high and it's going to keep going higher, at least statistically, that if a stock is at an all-time high, the probabilities are pretty good that it'll continue going higher. That's what the research shows. Now, that being said, obviously, castles aren't built to the sky. Stocks don't just go up without going down. So the risk is you don't know where the top is, and you don't know how far it's going to go up because there's not a lot of support up there. There's no other data points that technical analysts look at. But there are plenty of schools of thought around that. And I think that's really, investors are more momentum-based or growth-based. That's a real aspect of what people do. And there's nothing wrong with it. And there's plenty of success that people have had through that. But this comes back to a lesson we talk about on the show a lot, is understand your own investor psychology. If you are a value investor and you're trying to be a momentum investor, it's going to be really hard. Not to say that you can't change, you know, a leopard can change its spots in investing world, but you need to understand how you look at things. And you need to find a strategy that matches up with the way you do things. So Barb is a value investor. I have definitely a lot of value investor tilt to what I do. But, you know, I think you also have to be adaptable because value has been out of favor for the last decade or plus. And there'll be a time where it'll come back in favor. Some would argue it's back in favor this year, not at this taping, but it's certainly on that trend. And so I think just understanding that, you know, no matter which way you invest, you need to stick, you know, stay with your knitting, as people say, and just stick with what you know. And I think you'll have more success doing that than trying to be something you're not. Because there are times where your style will go in out of favor, and that's okay. You need to have a long-term perspective, assuming that that's your style, because a lot of technical analysts are short-term, as we found out, because time frames are important. So as we kind of wrap it up here, Barb, what are some final thoughts you have on this interview?
This interview really brings to the fore two factors. One is, it's wise to be diversified. For example, if all I owned were value stocks, my portfolio would have been crap for quite a while. Fortunately, I have chosen a diversified portfolio, which means there is access to a wide range of asset classes, all predominantly through index funds and geographies and size of different companies. And so, yeah, I'm never going to have the best return portfolio of everyone, nor am I ever going to have the worst return. So the takeaway is twofold. One is be diversified because you don't know in the future what type of style or what type of assets will be the outperformers. And so you will protect yourself from grave losses if you do have a diversified portfolio. And then the second thing is education. If you are into investing in a way that you want to be a do-it-yourself investor, which means you want to buy and sell stocks or options or bonds or funds or whatever, then it is your responsibility to educate yourself because that way you will be the most successful. If you don't want to be a do-it-yourself investor, then that's okay too because you can go with a financial advisor, someone like Kirk or another financial advisor of your choosing, or you can go the robo-advisor route and just pick an automated digital investment manager. That's an option for you too. So I am Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance, Robo-Advisor Pros, and on YouTube. See you next time, Kirk.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. My final thoughts too is I really appreciate Patrick coming on the show. I know he does a great service with his daily emails, the chart report. I highly recommend everyone sign up for it. We're a special price for listeners only of free. So yeah, I would definitely sign up for that. You'll learn a lot from it. And I think it just kind of comes back to my prior point, you know, invest in what you know. Something Barb said actually just wanted to touch on is I'm certainly seeing this a lot lately. I'm seeing a lot more new clients are coming in with like 100% or 90% equity portfolios. And we're not going to give you advice on the show. You need to do your own research or find a financial advisor that can help you. But, you know, if you're trying to beat the index and you're all in equities, you need to understand the risks you're taking. And whether you're a technical analysis or fundamental analyst, either way, you know, risk management is really important. And I think that's actually one thing that's really attractive when it comes to technical analysis is there is some risk management built in if you do it right. So ultimately, either get really good at it or hire somebody that is, but you know, find a style that works for you. Don't just look at the reward because we've had some good guests on that have had some significant rewards. Don't just look at the reward, look at the risk because if you make 100% return and then you lose it all, it doesn't really matter about that 100%. So risk management is very important. Whether you're using fundamental analysis or technical analysis, you need to do your research and your risk management. So that's it for the show this week. Thank you again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out the show on moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to our show notes, resources, and archive shows. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.